turn with me, if you will, to the 22nd chapter of Bamidbar, or the book of Numbers in the wilderness. And we ended last week on the first verse of this chapter, where it talks about the children of Israel having journeyed. They pitched in the plains of Moab, somewhere beyond the Jordan, near Jericho, or at Jericho. And the first word in the portion says, Ve-yara-yare-belak. And a fellow named Balak, son of Zippor, saw. What did he see? He saw all the stuff that we talked about at the end of last week's Torah portion. What had happened to the Amorites, Og, king of Bashan, and the king Sihon, and how basically they had their heads handed to them. And Balak was concerned about this. Moab was sore afraid of the people it begins, because there were so many of them. Moab was overcome with dread because of the children of Israel, and probably rightfully so. So he goes to the people of Midian and says, all right, here's the problem. Now this multitude is going to lick up everything that is round about us, just the way an ox licks up the grass of the field. And Balak, son of Zippor, was king of Moab at that time. And he decided he was going to send some messengers to a fellow who was basically the TV evangelist of the day, although not the evangelist for the right God, as it turns out. His name was Balaam, son of Beor. And there is a lot of discussion about exactly who this fellow is descended from. Baal Peor is a similar term, and there's some speculation that maybe that's what we're talking about, and in terms of the area here. Anyway, the king Balak sends messengers to this prophet, Balaam, and he called to him, and he said, behold, there is a whole lot of folks coming up out of Egypt, and they cover the face of the earth, and they abide over against me. So now I pray you, curse them for me. They're too big of a deal for me to handle on my own. Peradventure, I can prevail, and we might smite them and drive them out of the land, because I know the following. Now, whoops, did we lose things? We lost Whistler in the room, it looks like. Let me check. Okay, we're still up. Looks like Whistler is down for a second, so we'll pause. Okay, Whistler's in the room, but he's lost the mic. Okay, so let me know if anybody's still hearing me in Shoutjeep. I think we're still connected that way. It certainly looks like we are here, and things are copacetic. Okay, so Mark's back up. All right, good. We're back. Anyway, so here we are. We're talking about verse 6 in the first chapter of the Torah portion this week. And it has to do with this offer that's being made to this prophet, Balaam, by the king, Balak, the Midianite. And he asks basically prophet of Baal Peor to curse these Israelite people for him. And he says the following. Now, this ought to sound a lot like something that we saw prophetically with respect to Abraham, right? The words are no chance. They're not by coincidence. I know, says this king to the pagan prophet, that he whom you bless is blessed, and he whom you curse is cursed. And at this point, I'll pause, because I want to make one other introduction as we go into this, and we've just seen one of the elements of it. There are all kinds of things that you'll see if you'll look through the Midrash about this, about who these people are, and a lot of it is extra-biblical for sure. And anytime you have this much of a character, Balaam is a character whose name appears many, many times in Scripture. This story and what happens afterwards is pretty famous, and it's a great reference, and there's some enigma to it as well, because the question always comes up, well, wait a minute, this guy does seem to be a genuine, real prophet. It's just, and he hears from Yah. How can that be? Because he's clearly not a man of Yah in the standard sense. He is a pagan, and he's not happy about what it is that he's going to have to do here. And, of course, there's a lot of spiritualization that therefore goes along with it, and things that people would want to conclude about this. And I can't blame them for speculating. I just want to make sure, as always, that I preface some of these remarks by saying, yeah, we don't know absolutely for certain why it is that Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh chose this fellow, but there is some pretty good indications, at least some things that people have offered up over the years. One of the ones that I remember seeing repeatedly is this idea that, well, if other people, you know, if the non-Israelites had had a prophet as great as Moshe, then maybe they too would have had a better time of things. And it would seem that some have suggested that Bilaam is a response to that. We're going to see some other issues associated with it as well. But one of the big ones is this. It really does seem like this king, Balak, has watched what's gone on, and he's seen that these peoples, the people of Israel, come in, and they are basically, again, kicking butt and taking name of much more powerful armies than them. So clearly there is something going on here which is out of the ordinary. And Balak seems to almost kind of conclude, all right, well, maybe this isn't a physical battle after all. Maybe we need to fight it on a spiritual level. Trouble is, he goes to the wrong gods to try to get it done. And that's arguably the bigger lesson in all of this. All right, verse 7 says, the elders of Moab and the children, the elders of Midian, departed. And they came with the rewards of divination in their hand. You can see all the pagan aspects that are playing out here. They came to Balaam, and they spoke to him the words that they were told to say. And he said, hey, stay around, you know, hang out here for the night, and I will bring back word as Yahuwah may speak to me. So those princes of Moab did. They stayed with Balaam, and Elohim came, and he spoke to him. And he asks the rhetorical question up front, who are these men that are with you? It's basically, why are they here? Balaam says to him, Balak, son of Zippor, king of Moab, has sent unto me. And he said the following, behold, the people that come out of Egypt cover the face of the earth, so curse them for me. Peradventure, I can be able to fight against them and drive them out. And here comes the word of Yah to Balaam. He says, you are not to go out with them. You shall not curse the people, for they in fact are blessed. So this is unequivocal. Balaam gets up in the morning. He says to the princes of Balak, get on home. Go back to your land, for Yahuwah refuses to give me leave to go with you. Which is, I guess you'd have to say, a partial truth. It's a reasonable restatement of what he said, but of course, he was more specific. You're not allowed to curse the people, for they're blessed, and he didn't seem to tell them that part. Maybe he could work for CNN. The princes of Moab then rose up, and they went unto Balak, and they said, Balaam refuses to come with us. So the king decides, let's try something different. Send yet again more princes and more honorable, a higher-ranking folk next time. So they too go back to Balaam, said to him, here's what Balak, king of Midian and son of Zippor, says. Don't let anything, I pray you, hinder you from coming unto me, because I'm going to make it worth your while. I'll promote you unto very great honor. Anything you ask, I'll do for you. So come before, I pray you, and curse this people for me. Well, says Balaam to the servants of Balak, even if, and this almost sounds like he's dickering, doesn't it? Even if you give me a whole house full of silver and gold, I cannot go beyond the word of Yahuwah, my Elohim, to do anything, small or great. And it's interesting here that he refers to Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh as his Elohim. I guess the complete truth of the matter is he doesn't seem to be the only one that this guy is willing to serve for the price. So therefore, I pray you, you too, stick around just in case. Tarry here for the night so that I can determine whether or not he will speak to me anymore. Here's another one of these things that you sometimes hear. I remember when I was a kid growing up, my dad used to have a response, you know, to this idea of, you've already got an answer. The answer is no. What is it you don't understand? And that kind of seems to be the case. And the kid is again saying, well, you know, let's just see if maybe he'll change his mind. Elohim came to Balaam at night, said to him, if the men are come to call you, rise up and go with them. But only, only the word that I speak to you are you to do. So Balaam rose up in the morning, he saddled his ass, and he went with the princes of Moab, and this upset the creator of the universe. His anger was kindled because he went. Now, he's already told him not to go. And he basically seems to have said, look, if you are bound and determined to disobey me, and if they rise up and call on you, go with them. But he doesn't even wait for that, it would seem. He just gets up in the morning, saddles his asses, and goes. And that would seem to be one of several reasons why he was angry. And he sent a malach, an angel, a messenger, and the messenger of Yahuwah placed himself in the way. And literally, it says here, as an adversary. And that word, of course, adversary, is shatan, against him. Now, he was riding upon his ass. He had two servants with him. And the ass, who seems to be a better seer than the prophet, sees the angel of Yahuwah standing in the way. He has his sword drawn in his hand. And the good female donkey, and that's what an ass is, right? She turns aside out of the way, goes into the field. And Balaam is not happy about that. He smote his ass and turned her back on course. Well, we're not done yet. Now the angel of Yahuwah stands in a narrow way between vineyards. A fence on one side, a fence on the other side. The path is getting a little bit tighter. The ass again sees the angel of Yahuwah. She thrusts herself into the wall. And this time crushes Balaam's foot against the wall, and he whacked on her some more. We're still not done. So this time, the messenger, the malach of Yahuwah, goes one step further. He waited till they were in a narrow place where there's literally no way to turn around, either to the right or to the left. And now the ass again sees the malach of Yahuwah, and she lays down right under her master. And now he is really fired up, and he smote the ass with his staff. And at this point, Yahuwah decides it's time to do something which is kind of unprecedented of late. And this is probably the reason why this is one of the, well, certainly the most famous aspect of the story. Yeah, you could do a lot of stand-up comedy on this, and I have in years past, because it is a funny scene to think about the great prophet whose ass understands and sees better than he does what's really going on here. And I'm sure that there is no coincidence that the usage of that terminology in the English language has developed the way it has, in part because of, well, this story. So it says, Yahuwah opened the mouth of the ass. Now she says to Balaam, what's the problem? Why have you done this to me? Why have you smitten me these three times? What have I done to you? And Balaam doesn't seem to be at all, you know, he doesn't pause. He doesn't miss a step. He says to the ass, well, because you've mocked me. Recognize that word there in the Hebrew. It's the same word, root word for laugh. Yitzhak is same root word there. You've mocked me. If I had a sword, I would have killed you. And the ass isn't done. She says to Balaam, am I not your ass upon whom you've ridden all your life long up until this very day? Now think about this. This poor donkey has literally been saddled and carried this guy around for a long time, and he keeps whacking on her, and she says, look, haven't I been faithful to you all this time? Was I ever want to do anything like this to you before? As a matter of fact, have you ever heard me talk to you before? Well, no, he says. And now, and only now, does Yahuwah open the eyes of Balaam, and he sees this frightful specter of the messenger of Yah standing in the way with his sword drawn in his hand and figures it out. You know, I came about that close to losing it all here. He bows his head, he falls on his face. And now it's the angel of Yahuwah that speaks to him and says, why have you smitten your ass these three times? Behold, I have come forth as an adversary, Satan, against you, because your way is contrary to me. He is speaking on behalf of Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh as an adversary to Balaam. Your ass saw me. She turned aside before me three separate times. And unless she had turned aside and saved your ass, surely by now I would have slain you and left her alive. At this point, Balaam says to the messenger of Yahuwah, you know, I think I get it. I have sinned. I didn't know that it was you that stood in the way against me. So now, if it displeases you, I'll get myself on back home. Or just get me back. All right, says the messenger. Go with the men. But only, are you listening? Only the word that I speak unto you, that is what you will speak. So Balaam continued to do what he was bound and determined, almost at the loss of his own life, to do. He goes with the princes that Balak had sent. And now the king hears that Balaam had come. He went out to meet him. Ir Moab, which is on the border of Arnon, the uttermost part of the border. And he says to Balaam, didn't I not earnestly send unto you to call you? Why didn't you come? Can't I do what I've said I'd do? Can't I promote you to honor? Well, says Balaam to the king, Balak, look, I have come unto you. Have I any power at all to speak anything? In other words, I'm going to say what it is that I have been told to say, you know, as if by this point, maybe he's beginning to get the message. The word that Elohim puts in my mouth, that is what I shall speak. So, the two of them go together to a place called Kiriath Huzot, and Balak sacrificed oxen and sheep. He sent to Balaam, princes that were with him, and it came to pass in the morning that the king took Balaam, and he brought him up to Bamot Baal. And he saw from there the utmost part of the people. So he's on the first of, as it turns out, three mountains, going to look down over the assembled multitude, the mixed multitude of the children of Israel. And the prophet says to the king, build me here 7 altars, prepare for me 7 bullocks and 7 rams. 7 altars, 7 bulls, 7 rams. So Balak did as the prophet had spoken, Balaam, and together they offered on every altar a bull and a ram. And Balaam says to the king, Balak, stand by your burnt offering and I'll go. Maybe, just peradventure, Yahuwah will come to meet me, and whatever he shows me, I will tell you. So he went to the heights, and Elohim met Balaam, and he said to him the following, I have prepared the 7 altars, and I have offered up a bull and a ram on every altar. And Yahuwah did. He speak to the prophet, he put a word in his mouth, and he said, return to Balak, and this is what you'll tell him. So he did. He went back to the king. He stood by his burnt offering. He and all the princes of Moab took up his parable, and he said the following, from Aram Balak brings me, the king of Moab from the mountains of the east. Come, curse me Jacob, he says. Come, execrate Israel. So here's what I've been told to do. But, he continues, how shall I curse whom God, whom Elohim has not cursed? And how shall I execrate whom Yahuwah has not execrated? From the top of the rocks I see him, from the hills I behold him. Lo, it's a people that shall dwell alone, and shall not be reckoned among the nations. Who has counted the dust of Jacob, or numbered the stock of Israel? Let me die the death of the righteous, and let my end be like his. You know, that doesn't sound like a curse at all, does it? Balak says to Balaam, what have you done to me for crying out loud? I told you, I brought you here to curse my enemies. And behold, you have in fact done the wrong thing. You have blessed them altogether. Well, says the prophet, hey, don't I need to take heed to speak that which Yahuwah puts in my mouth? Well, says king to him, come on, I pray you, go with me somewhere else. Let's see if we can't, you know, it's almost like a Dr. Seuss story at this point. Maybe that's where Dr. Seuss gets it. I do not like green eggs and ham. No, let's go somewhere else. Let's see if we can try it another time. Come, we'll go to another place. Someplace else where you can see them. You can see the utmost part of them. You won't be able to see them all. And there, maybe there you can curse them for me from there. So this time he takes him to a field of Zophim, the top of Pisgah, and again they build 7 altars, 7 bulls, 7 rams on each one, one on each, of course. And he says to Balak, stand here by your burnt offering while I go towards a meeting over yonder. And again, Yahuwah meets the prophet, puts a word in his mouth, and says, speak thusly to Balak when you return to him. So he got the word, he goes back, and he tells the king who was standing by his burnt offering and the princes of Moab with him, hey, what did he tell you? Well, here it is. So he took up his parable and he said, arise, Balak, and hear. Give ear unto me, you son of Zippor. Elohim is not a man that he should lie, nor is he the son of man that he should repent, change his mind. When he has said, Will he not do what he has said? Or when he has spoken, will he not make it good? Behold, I am bidden to bless, and when he has blessed, I cannot call it back. None hath beheld iniquity in Yaakov, nor has anyone seen perverseness in Israel. Yahuwah, his Elohim, is with him, and the shouting for the king is among them. God, who brought them forth out of Egypt, is for them like the lofty horns of the wild ox. No enchantment, no divination, no witchcraft is with Yaakov, nor is there any divination with Israel. Now it said of Yaakov and of Israel, what hath Elohim wrought? This is the famous words that were sent by Samuel F.B. Morse. Very first time a telegraph was ever used. What hath God wrought? And one other interesting thing about this, you notice several times here he is referred to the sons of Israel by both the physical reference, Jacob, and the spiritual reference, Israel. Now, that's my take on the two things. But remember, Israel and Jacob are one and the same person. It's just that when we look at Scripture, oftentimes we see that that distinction seems to be made, that when there are reference to them in a physical sense, or in a sense of, if you will, fallen men, we often see the use of Jacob, and when it's Israel, it's talking about something that's perhaps a little bit more spiritually inclined. And here, the blessing is for both. Behold, he continues. And this is another one of those interesting comments. Behold, a people that rises up as a lioness, and as a lion, he lifts himself up. He will not lie down until he eats the prey and drinks the blood of the slain. And as I was reading that, this first time I've read that, and actually I thought, wait a minute, you know, we're talking about Israel here. The reference is kind of interesting. Since when does anyone of Israel drink blood? Right? We know what it's referring to, but on the other hand, it does seem kind of strange. And as I was thinking about it, it came to me, of course, that throughout Scripture, we will see this reference to lefi of the sword, the mouth of the sword, not just slain by the sword, but literally slain by the mouth of the sword. And that's a reference to when Israel takes the blood at sword point of the pagans. So it does make sense in this case that it's the sword, it's the mouth of the sword that, if you will, drinks the blood of the slain. Well, Balak is not happy again. He says to the TV prophet of his day, Balaam, neither curse him at all nor bless him at all. In other words, if you ain't going to do what I ask you, for crying out loud, quit blessing him, right? Balaam answers and he says to Balak, look, didn't I tell you that all Yahuwah speaks that I must do? Well, he ain't done yet. He says to Balaam, look now, I'm going to take you to another place. Well, we're 0-2. Let's try a third place. Maybe just this time it'll please God that you might curse them from there for me. And here we're going to go kind of to the heart, the home of Baal worship, to the top of Har Peor. Baal Peor. He looks down, and that mountain allows them to look down upon the desert and to see, again, all of the people. Oh, okay. Question about versions. I didn't, the cues are helpful. I guess I missed it. But, some of you know that what I tend to do is, I look at, the actual one I'm looking at is called Mekon Mamre, and it is a combination interlinear. So I've got essentially the Hebrew on the one side, the English on the other side, and I really tend to like to teach from, the Hebrew. Now, I know a lot of folks don't understand the Hebrew, and I won't claim to be an expert at the language, but when there are interesting words and when there are things that are, let's just say, have nuance associated with them, I think it's real handy to be able to look at the Hebrew and see exactly which words are used there. This is what I sometimes refer to as a King James-ish translation. It's not specifically King James. And as a lot of you know anyway, as I go through this and do the summary, I'm not line by line trying to read from it so much as just summarize the story. And in this particular case, the story is detailed and interesting enough that I'm going through it in a little bit more specific and complete fashion than I might otherwise. But I do tend to paraphrase, as you have noticed. And sometimes I will colloquialize a little bit, put some of the terminology in modern language. So as far as what Bible Bible version I'm looking at, let's just say it is a reference to the Hebrew as close as we're able. And when in doubt, I will I'll have notes in the margin and a lot of things that reference and kind of draw the gist out of any number of versions. In other words, I'm not a King James only kind of guy. I'm not a real big fan of the not inspired version either. The ones that I tend to use the most, I've got sitting here in front of me, the Scriptures, which is a pretty good rendering. There are a couple of others well. I don't have a problem with the New King James. I recognize that none of the English translations, though, are perfect. And that's part of the reason why I tend to do what I do here. So I hope that answers the question. ISR is the Scriptures. Hebrew Scriptures is another one. I don't have that one sitting here, but I've got one somewhere close. I actually have a Geneva Bible sitting on the shelf as well, and I prefer that to the Authorized version too, for a number of reasons. All right, let's continue with the story. Balaam this time says to the king, Balak, all right, we're at Baal Peor, so let's do it again, man. Build me, see, that was a paraphrase, right? Build me 7 altars here, prepare for me 7 more bulls and 7 more rams. So, again, we're going to go through it. Balak did as Balaam had said, and they offered up a bull and a ram on every one of the altars. And when Balaam saw that it pleased Yahuwah to bless Israel, he didn't, as he had with other times, go to meet with enchantments, but instead he set his face toward the wilderness. And that, of course, that word is Ha-Midbar. Balaam lifts up his eyes, and he sees Israel dwelling tribe by tribe. And the spirit of Elohim comes upon him. So he took up his parable, and he said the following, the saying of Balaam, son of Beor, and the saying of the man whose eye is open, the saying of him who hears the words of Elohim, who sees the visions of the Almighty, fallen down, yet with opened eyes. And everybody has heard this version. How goodly are your tents, O Yaakov, your dwellings, O Israel. As valleys stretched out as gardens by the riverside, as aloes planted by Yahuwah, as cedars beside the waters, water shall flow from his branches, and his seed shall be in many waters, and his king shall be higher than Agag, and his kingdom shall be exalted. Elohim, who brought him forth out of Egypt, or Mitzrayim, is for him like the lofty horns of the wild ox. He shall eat up the nations that are his adversaries, and shall break their bones in pieces, and pierce them through with his arrows. Here's another reference to the lion and the lioness. He crouched as he lay down as a lion and as a lioness. Who shall rouse him up? And here I'm going to pause. Second part of verse 9, and make a reference to, it's something I've seen now for several years running. Another one of these midrashim that I pretty much I like. Some of you know Rabbi David Foreman. He's one of several that I basically read repeatedly and get a lot out of. I think the guy has some interesting insight. Of course, he too is reading others that have come before him and putting pieces together. So a lot of us will do that. If something that somebody points out is of value, great. You know, connect those dots. And he noticed the following. We have 7 times 7 times 7 going on here. In other words, we got 7 altars with a ram and a bull on each, 3 separate times on 3 different mountains overlooking the children of Israel. And each time there are 3 different blessings. And the connection that Rabbi Foreman makes to this is to say, hey, you know, go back and look at Genesis chapter 22, verses 17 and 18, and these are the famous blessings that happen after the Akedah, after the offering by Abraham of his son, Isaac. Your son, your only son. And essentially, it breaks down into 3 different pieces. 1, your children, your seed, will be great. Okay, that's a paraphrase of the first of several blessings that are offered right there in Genesis 22, verses 17 and 18. The second one is, they will destroy their enemies. Okay, and the third one is, that through them, through your progeny, your seed, the entire world will be blessed. And now we've seen in these three separate occasions, and this was the connection, in each case, the very last verse of the prophetic utterance that Balaam comes up with sounds a whole lot like what we've seen in these three separate cases. All right, at the end of the first one, in Numbers 23, verse 10, what is it that the prophet says? Well, basically, it boils down to there's going to be a whole lot of children. Who has counted the dust of Jacob or numbered the stock of Israel? Yeah, like the sands of the seashore. We've seen this prophecy, this reference, and here it is repeated again. Lots and lots of children. There'll be huge numbers of them. All right, then let's go to the next one. At the end of the second prophecy, Numbers 23, verse 24, we see this. And we've already read this. I mentioned the idea of they will basically kick butt and take names. Behold, a people rises up as a lion or as a lioness, and they won't lie down again till they eat of their prey and drink, or the blood of the mouth of the sword, at least, drinks the blood of the slain. They'll destroy their enemies. Okay, that is the second of the two prophecies right there out of what's given to Abraham. And then, of course, the third one. And this one is the one that's kind of interesting because it's close but no cigar. Okay, through them, through your children, the entire world will be blessed. This is, of course, the arguably the most famous of those prophecies. Now, what does it say here? Wait a minute. Close, but not quite the same. Talking about the lion and the lioness, it says, who shall rouse him up? And then it says this, blessed be everyone that blesses you, and cursed be everyone that curses you. Well, wait a minute, we've heard that not once. We've heard that several times. As a matter of fact, we started off the Torah portion with it. Isn't that interesting? And it is exactly what the pagan king tells the pagan prophet. I've heard that those that you bless are blessed, and those you curse are cursed. Well, wait a minute, no, you heard wrong, dude. We're talking about the king of the universe here. That's the one you ought to be talking about, and it was the prophecy that was given to Abraham. But what does it say? It says that, well, at least when we look at the third of those three prophetic things that are told to Abraham, through your seed, all of the world, the entire world, will be blessed. And this is close. Blessed be everyone that blesses you. Cursed be everyone that curses you. Now, Rabbi Foreman's conclusion is, hey, these are essentially multiple statements of the same thing. That through your seed, the entire world will be blessed, and blessed will be those that bless you, curse those that curse you. And I think, okay, that's great. You will also often hear those that are of the line of Judah, if you will, Rabbinic Judaism, Orthodox Judaism today, will look at these prophecies and they'll take a look at it in terms of the Jewish people. And as you know, I tend to distinguish, at the time we're talking about here, Israel, Kol Israel, consisted of 12 tribes, plus a mixed multitude with them. Not just the tribe of Judah, or not just those that would later be in the southern kingdom of Judah, Judah, Benjamin, and some of the Levites. And we tend to get all wrapped around the axle about some of these words that we tend to misuse anyway. So I want to try to be specific. You know, after the split, you had the 10 lost tribes in the north, and by and large, I think it's a reasonable understanding to say they were scattered, they became the Gentile nations, they went pagan. Later on, out of them came the Romanized, paganized Catholic Church. And don't kid yourself or us, there's a whole lot of sun god in the Romanized Church. There's Ishtar sun god elements. There's Mithras, the sun god. There's Christmas and Ishtar, Ashtaroth, the fertility goddess. There's a whole lot of paganism mixed in there. But what's interesting, of course, is I sometimes joke about the Reese's Pieces thing. You got your chocolate and my peanuts and vice versa. Because what you will hear the Orthodox Jews say is, wait a second, blessed be everyone that blesses you, cursed be everyone that curses you, through you the entire world will be blessed. Well, what does that mean? Oh, well, I know what it means. It means that through the Jewish people, the Torah will be preserved. And they make a good point. That is how the entire world is blessed. That is the aspect of this prophecy that kind of caps the three, the sets of three here that Bilaam is pointing out. And I have no problem with that except for the fact that it's incomplete. Now, what's incomplete about it, right? We're missing the peanuts or the chocolate, depending upon which way you look at it, in the Reese's peanut butter cup. Because essentially, yeah, the southern kingdom, Judah, did in fact preserve the Torah. And through them, the entire world will be blessed because we have the Tanakh, we have the scriptures, we have the Torah, and we have those who preserved it, along, of course, with the Creator who helped them do it, to thank for it. Great. So they got the Torah. And through them, the entire world will be blessed. But there's more. And of course, the Romanized church will correctly say, oh, well, it's through the Mashiach. Although they might use a different terminology, a little bit more pagan terminology. But it's through the Son of God that the entire world will be blessed. And they'll ignore the Torah. As if the Son of God, if Jesus Christ did away with it, nailed it to the cross. And of course, everybody that's read the Torah knows that would mean he ain't who he says he is. So he can't have done away with it. But still, it is true that blessed be everyone that blesses you, cursed be everyone that curses you, and it's the blessing and the cursing distinction there that I think is interesting. That's why this rephrasing, in one case, it's through them the entire world will be blessed. It's just a question of which them we're talking about and which aspect we're talking about. And on the other case, blessed be everyone that blesses you, cursed be everyone that curses you. It seems like we're talking about a distinction there. Here's the irony, folks. They're both the same if we understand that we're still talking about the Torah. The southern kingdom, Judah, the people of the book, preserved the written Torah. They got some oral tradition that goes with it as well. Meanwhile, on the northern kingdom side, Israel, the lost tribes, how is the entire world blessed through them? Yeah, through the Mashiach, and let's put it this way, the Torah made flesh. So blessed be those that bless you, cursed be those that curse you, and let's understand the key is obedience. To whom? Well, to him, Yod Heh Vav Heh, to his written Torah, and to the Torah made flesh that he came to bring us. If we look at it in this respect, I think it's fascinating what it is that this pagan prophet brings to the table. And essentially, who better than a pagan prophet, I guess, to say something that kind of combines two elements that people tend to want to overlook on behalf of either the chocolate or the peanuts, but never the Reese's peanut butter cup, at least not until we get to the point where hopefully we're heading today, where we can begin to see that there is more to the picture. All right, back to the story. I find that fascinating, at least. I hope that as we go through this and we see some of these things, maybe this picture becomes a little bit more complete. Meanwhile, King Balak, he is some kind of PO'd. His anger was kindled against the TV evangelist of the day, Bilaam. He smites his hands together, and he says to the prophet, look here, I called you to curse my enemies, and behold, you ain't done it, man. You have in fact blessed them these three times. So now, get out of here. Go to your place. I was looking to give you great honor, but your Yahuwah has kept you back from honor. Now, a pause, and just let the irony of that sink in for a minute. Because you have been obedient to the Creator of the universe, Yod Heh Vav Heh, that has kept you from honor. Oh, you think? Says Balaam to Balak, look, didn't I tell you, and also I told your messengers, the ones you sent to me, I said, look, even if you gave me a whole house full of silver and gold, I cannot go beyond the word of Yahuwah. He still remembers the angel in the doorway, I think. To do either good or bad out of my own mind, what Yahuwah tells me to speak, that's what I'm going to speak. So now behold, I'm going to go to my people, and I will announce to you what this people shall do to your people tomorrow, Tuesday, nope. In the end of days, in the end of days. So he takes up his parable and he said, the saying of Balaam, son of Beor, and the saying of the man whose eye is opened. I'm getting it. The saying of him who hears the words of Elohim and who knows the knowledge of the Most High, who sees the vision of the Almighty, fallen down, When did he fall down? Yeah, right? And yet with opened eyes, I see him, but not now. I behold him, but not right here on nigh. There shall step forth a star out of Yaakov, a star out of Yaakov, and a scepter shall rise out of Israel. What's the implication I usually try to draw from this? A star out of the physical aspect and a scepter out of the spiritual aspect. And they shall smite through the corners of Moab and break down all the sons of Set. Edom will be a possession. Seir also, his enemy, shall be a possession when Israel does valiantly. And out of Yaakov shall one have dominion and shall destroy the remnant from the city. And he looked on Amalek. Now remember, Amalek, Yahuwah will have war with Amalek from generation to generation. And he said, Amalek was the first of the nations, but his end shall come to destruction. And he looked on the Kenite, took up his parable, and he said, though firm be your dwelling place, and though your nest be set in the rock, nevertheless, Cain will be wasted. How long? Asher, Assyria, shall take you away captive. And he took up his parable, and he said, alas, who shall live after Elohim has appointed him? But ships shall come from the coast of Kittim, and they shall afflict Asher, and shall afflict Eber, and he also shall come to destruction. So he basically is laying out, and again, this is not something that is near at hand, but would seem almost, and we can begin to see some of the pieces of this if we follow the connections, perhaps lining up to still play out in yet the future from this point. Now, what's funny here is, says both of them, they parted company, Balaam rose up, he went back to his own place, Balak went on his way. But I'm going to pause and suggest, okay, we're not there yet. We got a few more chapters to go through, but we're going to see that the story is not over with Bilaam. And furthermore, even though he had eyes and he fell down yet with opened eyes and he saw these things and he spoke truly and his words have become immortalized, so by the way has his infamy. Because the next part of the chapter here, chapter 25, that takes us through the end of this week's portion, pretty well lays out how it is that, and I like to refer to him as kind of the Bill Clinton of his day, you know, because if we can't do it directly, there's always a way to work around it. You know, it all depends on what the meaning of the word is. And if I can't curse directly, I still want the money. I can find a way to get you to curse yourself. Isn't that clever? And that's essentially what seems to have happened. So here's the story. Israel abode in Shittim, and the people, why? We don't find out why till later. It says, though the people began to commit harlotry with the daughters of Moab. They defiled themselves with women. And that's a reference to what we see in the end of the book, in Revelation as well. And it's not just that they went out and they had a good time for a little bit of spare change on a weekend night. No, that's not the deal here. What they did, and we're reading between the lines, but understand that there are multiple ways that there can be harlotry described in Scripture. And the worst kind is the kind that is set apart, but not set apart to Yah. And it's not even merely about sex. It's about perverted, paganized worship involving ritual sexuality. And maybe that's as clean of a way as I can put it. But suffice it to say, it ain't unique in history. This was not the first, certainly not the last time that we saw this. You can look at places like the Temple of Dionysus and Ishtar and Astarte and Diana and all these pagan places where, let's just go have not just a little whoring, but a whole bunch of stuff that was explicitly worship of pagan goddesses and gods, and they did it with sex. And guess what? When nothing else worked, that was a way to get Israel to decide, oh yeah, hey, if there's sex involved, maybe we can have a little bit of nookie on the side here. Some pagan gods, that's cheaper than the other prices. So it says in verse 2, they called the people unto the sacrifices of their gods. You see? Sex was the lure. The people ate, and they bowed down to their gods, and Israel joined himself. Israel. Oh, yeah, that's the, pagan and yet spiritual aspect of Israel, joins himself unto the Baal, the lords of Peor, that place where the third and final attempt was made. And the anger of Yahuwah was kindled against Israel. What do we find out later? Yeah, it was Balaam that had the idea. If you can't curse them directly, we'll get them to curse themselves. So now, Yahuwah returns and speaks to Moshe. Take all the chiefs of the people, hang them up unto Yahuwah in the face of the sun, that the fierce anger of Yahuwah may turn away from Israel. He is some kind of upset. Yahuwah says to the judges of Israel, slay every one of the men who have joined themselves this way unto Baal of Peor. Behold, one of the children of Israel came and brought unto his brethren a Midianitish woman in the full sight of Moshe and in the sight of all the congregation of the B'nai Israel while they were weeping at the door of the tent of meeting. So picture the scene here. They have gone out a-whoring and not just, again, committing sexual sin. This is sexual sin in the names of the so-called gods, Baal Peor, the lords of Peor. But they're not done. Even after the people who did this, Moshe says, hang them up, they are gonna go one step further. So, one of the children of Israel brought this Midianitish woman in the full sight of Moshe and the whole of the congregation while they're weeping at the door of the tent of meeting because of the nastiness that's come upon them. We gotta set the scene here. Because now we're gonna introduce a fellow, Pinchas, and next week's Torah portion is gonna continue the story, so we're almost to the cliffhanger. But actually, what's ironic, in the end of this week's portion, we're going to see the gist of the whole story of Pinchas, and of course, two other folks as well. So, Pinchas, son of Eleazar, son of Aaron the priest, this is a grandson of the high priest, sees it. He rises up from the midst of the congregation, took a spear in his hand, and he went after the man of Israel into the chamber where he was doing the dirty deed with this Midianitish woman, and he thrust both of them through. They were an easy target right there together. The man of Israel and the woman through her belly. They were nailing one another. He nailed them. And the plague was stayed from the children of Israel. Now, we're going to find out, again, more detail next week, and we'll find out after that how it is that Balaam is connected to this, but we've pretty well already laid all of that out. The last verse in the portion tells us the following. People that died by the plague, 24,000, as a result of the efforts here of this prophet, this televangelist of Baal Peor, to get people sucked in to a pagan religion in violation of the very blessings that have now stood and still stand, but that they managed to work themselves out of. So it is considered a tradition, I guess, when the sages divvied up the Torah portions, that they would try not to let a portion end on a really negative note, okay? So basically, if you had the portion end at pretty much the end of the chapter here where Pinchas takes a spear and chucks it through both of these folks, that might be considered a little bit negative. And I guess it is. But at least we have this note in there that while 24,000 people did die by the plague as a result of what happened, at least by this action, and we'll pick up the story with Pinchas next week, by this action, the plague was stayed from the B'nai Israel. So there's the good news as the portion ends. All right, we will pause at that spot, and we'll talk a little bit after we get back from one more song about the implications of some of this and what's going on in the news today. And I guess, and probably tomorrow I'll mention this as well, because as I was looking through things and thinking about notes for this Shabbat, it occurred to me that while we don't have too many equivalents of Balaam, the prophet, you know, the televangelist, real popular dude of the day, who actually does in fact hear from Yah, maybe there are some, but I'm not aware of any of the televangelists I can think of offhand that would kind of fall into that camp. We certainly do have a whole lot of folks that would sound like Barak or Balak or a king that is looking to curse people spiritually. That, at least, we can see all over the place.